HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 362, recorded live Thursday, March 7th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, training developers to work smarter, and now offering Gesture Pack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Miguel de Acasa about making iOS, Android, Windows Phone, and Windows apps, all using C#.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we've got the one and only Miguel de Acasa. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much.
You just launched something big, and it has a 2.0, which means it's better than 1.0.
It is better. Yeah, it is much better.
What have you done that has the world in a tizzy?
So we actually followed some advice from some friends of us, and it was a cultural change for us because we're used to the open source development mode where we deliver new features on a weekly basis. So every week you would see an improvement. And while that works, it's also a bit distracting for rolling out large changes or rolling out a bunch of interesting features together. So we've actually been working in parallel for almost a year on many different things. One of them was we introduced support to Visual Studio for iOS, for iOS development. So developers now can use Visual Studio to basically maintain a single solution for their for iOS, Android, Windows Phone, Windows 8, ASP.NET solutions. So you can do everything from a single from your favorite IDE, and that actually took a lot of time to make sure that we got a good iOS and Android experience. So that was the first part of it. The second one is that for about a year we've been, since we launched the company, we essentially used a number of open source tools that were created originally by the community. And like many other open source projects grow organically. Features are added without really much architectural oversight. And probably the most common, a very common problem resolution thing that happens in open source is whenever there are two opinions or two ways of doing something, you don't want to offend somebody. So the way of resolving conflict is instead of making a decision, you add a checkbox and you basically support two different opinions. And if there's a third opinion, you'll change that checkbox to a combo box. And now you have three opinions or four opinions and so on. So our previous IDE had a lot of this historical baggage of trying to not upset somebody or trying to support every possible feature that people wanted. So we went back to the drawing board and we figured if this is going to be the IDE that people use when they're using a Mac or the IDE that they use when they're not using Visual Studio, they need to have a much better experience than this mess.
So you're saying that the design by committee way of doing things in the past was kind of holding you guys back?
Yeah, definitely. The user experience was not great. Then you have two code paths and you have to test two code paths. So you have different bugs that happen depending on different combinations of features that people chose. So we didn't eliminate all the options, but we eliminated the most obvious ones and we made it a lot simpler. When we looked at the IDE, one of the things that was there in our IDE was the standard toolbar that everybody has. And there's a great talk from Jensen Harris from Microsoft about how they rethought the toolbar for Office. Now, Office has its own set of requirements, but when we looked at our own IDE and reflecting a little bit on Jensen's talk, we had things like save and close file and open file, which it's very rare for people to actually use a toolbar to do those things. Cut, paste, and copy are another set of icons that, at least for me, even after all these years, I always have to hover over one of these buttons to remember which one was which. So it became obvious that some of these things are much better suited just to live in menus and just to be options in the application or shortcuts that people know by heart. So that helped us a lot clean up the UI, realizing that all of those things were a little bit of a tradition. And it was a tradition based on fads of the 90s, not really grounded on usability, or not really grounded on actually watching people develop software or use the software. So we spent about a year redesigning and prototyping and rewriting over and over. We threw out a lot of prototypes. We threw out a lot of code. But the end result, I think, is very pretty. It feels fresh. It's much faster. We sacrificed a lot of code that we had built over the years with a lot of love, but it had to be removed. It didn't make any sense.
What is the relationship then between MonoDevelop and Xamarin Studio?
So we have Xamarin Studio is at this point based on the MonoDevelop core. So we take the official MonoDevelop source code and we add the extensions for doing iOS, Android, and Mac development, plus our component store, which I haven't really talked about yet. But it is essentially built on top of the open source one. Now, we developed all of these enhancements in private for a year. We prototype privately for a year. And at the time of the launch, we merged all of our fixes upstream with MonoDevelop. So the open source MonoDevelop has everything that we did. All of the new UI, all of the new redesign is there. The only thing that it doesn't have is the branding. It's called MonoDevelop instead of Xamarin Studio. And it doesn't have the component store or the iOS and Android pieces.
When companies like yours kind of straddle the open source and paid software kind of world, I could see someone reacting to this and saying, oh, you know, MonoDevelop's dead, long live MonoDevelop. Or they would say, oh, well, your license is $1,000 now. What about poor little me? How are you going to kind of straddle the open source love that Xamarin gives to everything and the all of that with you guys need to make some money?
Yeah, so there was a little bit of the first one when we launched, because people thought that we had completely forked MonoDevelop. So we quickly addressed that question, and it really helped that the people in the Linux community and the Debian community actually packaged MonoDevelop within 24 hours. So within 24 hours, we had Debian and Ubuntu packages with the latest and greatest. So when you run MonoDevelop on Linux and Ubuntu, you would get the same experience that you get on Mac and Windows without the branding, right? Or without the other add-ons, the iOS and Android one. So at least that one was an easy question to answer. We're contributing upstream. We merged all the changes upstream. And at this point, we're continuing all the work in the open. Now that we had our chance of prototyping and designing and cleaning up the IDE. The second piece, it is actually very interesting, because since we've been working on, to me, it's very interesting because I spent a decade or, more than a decade, actually, holy moly, it's a lot more. It's 20 years. Is that 20 years? Oh yeah, 20 years in open source. So I've been doing open source for 20 years. And it was about 20 years ago that I stopped using DOS machines and Windows and switched completely to Unix. And I stayed with Unix and with Linux up until about a year and a half ago in those communities. And when we launched Xamarin, it's a company that delivers tools for building iOS and Android apps on Windows and on Mac. So we've not really been interacting with the Linux community very much. And it was very surprising for me, and I guess to you this is what you see every day, but it was very surprising to me to see a completely different side of developers. On Linux, it would be unheard of to sell software. It's almost unheard of for people to try to sell software. And I think that the moment that you try to sell something, somebody rewrites it from scratch as open source. But in the proprietary world, in the Windows and Mac world, it was fascinating to me to see people willing to pay for software to get features. And it's been a little bit of a shock after spending 12 years out in the wilderness that is open source.
Well, a small side discussion. If Linux people won't pay for software, how are they paying the rent? Like, what is it that they're building? If everyone refused to pay for anything, they only pay for services? They only pay for help? What are they doing all day?
I don't really know. I mean, I think that they do services. I think that there's a culture of it's okay to pay for services and updates, but not to charge for software. Obviously, Red Hat and SUSE have made a business of selling services and support. But as a software programmer, you know, we tried making the software. We tried to make software companies on pure open source work on Linux for many years, and we failed at my previous company with Zeemian. It was very difficult to get people to pay for free software, and I guess it shouldn't have really surprised anyone, but those were the roaring, you know, 2000s when Linux was going to take over the world. And it became very clear that it was only a few people that were in a position to actually monetize open source. You had to be a big company like Red Hat or Novell. But the majority of the small guys could really only make money out of services, which is fine, services and support. But as a software developer, it's a little bit demoralizing because I want to write software, I want to create things, I want to shape things, I want to design software. And that's not something that the Linux community likes to pay for. Mm-hmm. So as a software developer, it was a little bit of a bummer that your work is not considered something worth paying for compared to maintenance and consulting. So in the proprietary world, you kind of have those two options. If you like consulting and support, you can do that. Or if you want to sell software, you can do that. And I know this is all very basic to your listeners,
it's interesting to understand because, I think this may be a simplistic way of looking at it, but ultimately you pay for value. And I'm always amazed in all things. I don't want to like turn the whole podcast into a pricing discussion, but like I was talking to a professional developer and he's going to buy a new laptop. And I was telling him that I thought he should stretch a little bit. He should pay a little bit more than, you know, he was like, well, he was looking for a laptop around $700 or $800. And I said, you know, for $1,300, you're going to get, it's $500 more, but you're going to get 10 times the laptop. And we went kind of around and around about that. And I was just thinking to myself, even if the laptop lasted 2 years, which is, you know, pretty short lifetime for a laptop, mm-hmm. you're looking at about $1 a day, 80 cents a day. And you're going to have a piece, you know, just, you're going to have joy just every possible
yeah,
second.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And like the middle, I think the middle SKU of Xamarin Studio is like $1,000. And I could totally see people saying, you know, I'm a poor student. I can't possibly pay $1,000. Or even an enterprise saying, oh, we're a poor enterprise. I can't possibly pay $1,000. But then I'm thinking, you know, for $3 a day, you're going to get this amazing, you're going to be sitting on the shoulders of giants who have been working on this forever and you pay for value. But it sounds like you've actually got an indie version of this and
yeah,
a starter version. What are those?
Yeah, we got a couple of options. So first off, we also offer a student discount. So students get they get it all, right, for almost nothing. But we have a starter edition that is free to use. It has a few limitations. It has a limitation on the size of your program, so you can't build really large apps. But you get to use everything for free. The second one is the indie that removes that restriction. So there's no limitation on what you can use at that point or how big your applications can be. So we figured that the starter was a good way of striking a balance between a lot of people that came to us and said, I want to learn the platform. I want to learn iOS. I want to learn Android. And and having a for-pay product. So we addressed that particular segment of the population. There's still a lot of people that say it should be free for open source, but that's a little bit trickier, right? Because they say, well, if I open source my project, should I get a refund? You know, things like that. So we didn't really address those scenarios. We get a lot of creative suggestions as to when we should charge and when we should not charge for open source. And I don't think we've come up with a solution. If one day we find something that works, we'll definitely do it. I mean, my heart is still very much with the open source community, but it just happens that my heart leans a little bit more towards the sides of paying my amazing engineers to create the beautiful software.
Yeah.
So we'll have to wait on that a little bit.
It's funny how people are sometimes apologetic about making money. You know, it's just like, yeah. Oh gosh, you know, I'm really sorry. I kind of, you know, I have to charge because I have to eat.
Yeah, no kidding. But you know, you're right about this thing about the laptop and buying yourself a laptop. I mean, as a software developer, probably one of the best investments. I think that there are two big investments that you should make if you're writing software. One is, three. One is getting good at hardware. The second one is getting a good chair. You know, it will do wonders for your back and your hands. And the third one is to learn to touch type.
You know, that's amazing that you said that, because I'm always talking about, you know, chair, bed. These are all things you spend a third of your life sitting on your chair. It should be an awesome chair. You spend a third of your life sleeping. It should be totally an epic bed.
Like, yeah,
for absolutely. Goodness sake, don't waste money on a lousy mattress. But then yesterday I was teaching at this university. I did a guest lecture at Oregon Institute of Technology, and I, for some reason, the conversation turned into typing and about the idea of being I/O bound. And it was like, you know, I can't imagine how many people are completely I/O bound, that they're not, you know, their brain has solved the problem, but they're just waiting for their fingers to like finish buffering.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm a good typist. I can do sustained about 80 words per minute. If I'm lucky, I'll do 100. Mm-hmm. But Nat Friedman, he can sustain 120. And when he gets lucky, I've seen the guy do 170. It is ridiculous. I could not believe my eyes. And you spent, you know, it is an issue of bandwidth. Mm-hmm. It is the tool that you use every day, and it limits what you do when you're writing code. Like, it's very obvious to me when you see somebody writing code that a fast typist has no problem documenting what he did, right? He adds comments, explains the problem, because to him, it's just a fraction of a second to go and write all of this stuff. Well, people that don't touch type, they tend to be the ones that that come up with reasons like, well, I'll document it when it's finished. I'll document it when the API is complete. I'm still going to make some changes. I'm not going to document it. So it does, it's not only a bandwidth issue. It really changes the way that you develop software and the things that you can do. And in my opinion, if you're not documenting what you do, you're wasting, you're wasting your time. People don't have a way of finding or understanding what you did.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to get back to the product. Sorry, this is always so fun. We should have like three podcasts here. But I wanted to understand how you pulled this off. And I'm looking at the way that Xamarin Studio is kind of looking at the screenshots and stuff. And it looks to me like I need a Mac and I don't need a Mac. Like, I don't need a Mac to write the code, but to run it, it looks like you kind of attached to a remote running process and then like a VNC into an iOS simulator on some Mac, so that I could have a farm of Macs that my people could all kind of attach to.
Right. So the issue with so this is a Visual Studio iOS product. The Apple makes it very clear that if you want to develop iOS applications, you need to use a Mac. It is part of their agreement. So we just happen to follow the rules that Apple has set. So one developer, one Mac. The second piece is that there are a number of things that you need the Mac to do. Code sign your application, run the simulator, run the Xcode designer. So you still need a Mac to do some of those operations. because we just don't have today a designer, and I don't think we'll ever have our own simulator. I don't think we're going to simulate iOS ourselves. So you want to use the iOS simulator, which makes it a lot simpler to build and test your application quickly. Mm-hmm. When I was building my own Twitter client, the one with the chicken noises, mm-hmm. It is probably the only Twitter client with chicken noises. I did most of the work on the simulator. I barely had to use the device. You only use the device when you need to try test the camera and test geolocation. But other than that, you don't really need to deploy the device. And it's so much faster to just target the simulator. You know, you have a big fat Core Duo, whatever's the latest megahertz, gigahertz thing on your desktop versus this tiny little device where you have to upload the software and run it there. So the developer experience is just so much better to have it running on your Mac than deployed to device, in my opinion.
So what is the experience? I'm sitting in Visual Studio. I'm writing C# code. I hit F5. Mm-hmm. And then how does it show up on an iPhone?
So it depends on the configuration that you have. So just like in Visual Studio where you have debug and release, you can have debug and release to simulator and debug and release to device. So if you choose debug or release on device, when you hit F5, it compiles the application, deploys it on your iPhone, and your iPhone launches the app. And if you have breakpoints, it will break into Visual Studio and you'll single step from there. If you're using the simulator, there are two scenarios. One is you have your machines side by side. So you have your Mac and your Visual Studio machine side by side, two monitors. So the simulator will pop up on the other monitor. The other scenario is you're using virtualization. So you're running Windows in a VM. Mm-hmm. And when you start the application, we send the simulator to the foreground. And when we hit a breakpoint, we send Visual Studio and your VMware configuration to the foreground. So it, I personally would go with that path, single machine, a Mac, and virtualized Windows. That's probably the best. But I understand that some people might have some beefed up Dell computers with, I don't know how many, 32 CPUs, and they might want to take advantage of that. So it's just my personal choice. I do everything on a laptop, so I would use virtualization, but some of our guys use beefed up machines and just do displays.
So I've got choices, though. I mean, I could do this with lots of VMs, or I could have a Mac somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. So it's as if it's a, like I think about it in the context of web development where I've got different targeted browsers. I'm going to launch a process. I'm going to inject my code into it, and then I'm going to see it as it relates on that simulator. And can I look at it on an iPhone 5 and an iPhone 4 and all those different things? Those are all settings I change in the simulator, and it just works.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the first piece. You can definitely do it in a simulator. Or the other option is you have a little farm of your devices with different operating systems. Probably more important for Android because the majority of Android devices are running very old versions of Android. And Apple, they're really good at updates. They're amazing at updates. I think that most iOS developers at this point are just targeting iOS 5 and higher. And some people are just saying iOS 6. It's they've got a good thing going there. Mm. Mm-hmm.
And do I have to buy different products for iOS and Android, or do I just buy one thing?
Yes, you need to buy our iOS and Android products are separate. You buy them separately, or if you choose to buy them both, I think we have a discount. I don't know what the discount is, but you get a bundle discount.
But I guess what I'm saying is Xamarin Studio I could use in one place, and then I just have to add on, or am I using two different IDEs?
Correct. The IDE is either Visual Studio or Xamarin Studio, and you add to either one of them the iOS or Android features. So when you purchase, all we do is we enable the iOS or Android features on your IDEs, but the IDE is the same.
Okay. And I had talked to you kind of privately about portable libraries, this idea that you could share lots and lots of code. And I know that recently, I think there's a pre-release of HTTP client so that you could make calls from portable libraries now. Mm-hmm. Does that work in Xamarin?
Yeah, so we actually have HTTP. We wrote our own HTTP client. So both our iOS and Android versions do have that. So we don't need the PCL version. We already have it. But there's a tremendous amount of value in the portable class libraries. So we've been working with some of your team members at Microsoft. They've been absolutely amazing at answering every small little question that we've had about how PCL actually works. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to report that that just this week we're doing the integration work here in the Boston office to get portable class libraries into all of our products. It's been a long road because I started not really knowing very much about PCLs. But really, thank you to the guys at Microsoft. We're going to have full support for PCLs, and you'll be able to share the same PCL on iOS, Android, desktop, Mac, and mm-hmm. all of the Visual Studio products that you guys support.
What can those guys do if they're listening, or what could the community do to support portable libraries more? Because, I mean, I think portable libraries are just a killer feature. Just the idea that I could, I mean, just now I'm kind of visualizing like my little startup, my theoretical startup, and I've got everything loaded up in Visual Studio, and I've got my Windows Phone, Windows 8, Android, iOS, and I'm sharing 70, 80% of my code in a PCL. That seems like perfect. What could they do to improve it?
Yeah, there's one particular profile. I don't remember which number is. These profiles are numbered mm-hmm. based on the target platforms that you want to aim for. And I don't remember the number, but there's one that will give you the most coverage across all platforms. So what you need to do is build portable class libraries that target that particular profile. From where we stand, we pride ourselves on having a super set of all of these things. So Monotouch and Monodraw really won't be the reasons why you have to downgrade in your PCL support. So it's a matter of just picking that one. I'll get back to you on which one is a preferred profile. I had a discussion with the team in the BCL runtime, and I can't remember which one was the one that we said, oh, this is a good one.
Yeah, I think it would be – I just think we as a community should keep putting pressure on them, because – That's what we want. You know what I mean? We want to be able to share as much as code as possible. Like I had the guys from, Draw a Stick Man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're sharing just a ridiculous amount of code. I mean, it totally blew me away.
Yeah, it was interesting. And they're also using XNA for their game, which I thought was very interesting. I have to say, for all these years, XNA is a word that was on my periphery, but I never really understood what it was. And I knew that was associated with games and did some kind of gaming thing, but
right.
That was it. And it wasn't until I saw the Hitsend guys talk about Draw a Stigman that I actually understood what XNA was. So I was like, right. Oh, that is really interesting. So we should do something to help those guys, the Monogame team.
Yeah, Monogame, I think, is what makes it happen. That's the amazing thing underneath there.
Yeah, and that's funny because I've been helping the Monogame guys without really knowing what Monogame did. So they came and said, can you help us with this and release notes and promotions? Like, yeah, sure. I just don't know what it does yet. Mm-hmm. But now I do. Now I do. Now I do.
So what is the store? You said that you had a store you hadn't talked much about.
All right. So the one thing that that happens is that when mobile developers get started, you write your Hello World application, your first button navigation, and you're kind of proud of it. And when it comes time to spice up your application and you compare your mobile app with what the professionals are doing, it feels a little bit lacking. It feels a little bit lacking. So this seems like a very natural fit for .NET's strong component system and strong component idioms to deliver third-party components. And it is, in a way, there's two things that we're doing with our components. One of them are components in the sense of being libraries that you can reuse, very much like NuGet, and I'll explain the difference with NuGet in a second. But the second piece are themes. So what happens is that when you build your application, you're very proud of your application. You show it to your friends, and they're not that impressed. Your buttons are white, the style is okay, but the bar for the user interface bar is very high now. People expect a lot of quality, a lot of attention to detail in applications, and that takes a lot of time. Somebody that is just building software, or there's an expert software developer and a craftsman, is not necessarily a great artist. So the distance that people have to travel from getting started with iOS and Android, building their application, and then making it a great application, as opposed to, yeah, I got an iOS app, is long. It's like a website. You start with a simple website, and then to make it a great website, you have to spend a ton of time on styling it and making sure that it looks great and feels great. So what we wanted to do was to make it very easy for people to style their applications. So we work with a design company called App Design Vault. They're great designers. And what we did is that we turned our designs into essentially a method call. So in your C# code, you just invoke one method and it styles your entire application with a particular theme. So you can give it a leathery theme or you can give it a flat theme. So the application goes from this very boring, very flat, very unprofessional look to a high quality app with a single call. So we really like that. I mean, I'm very proud of the work that we did with themes because it's not very technologically advanced. It's not compilers. It's not a JIT engine, but it makes a big difference into turning your app into something that looks very, very polished. And I would say that it's even better than doing it on the web, because with the web, you have to change styles and redo your templating and your CSS and go and patch things left and right. This is iOS has a good foundation and Android have a good foundation for theming. And we can theme the app with a single call. So I think we're the first ones that productized the theming in this way for iOS. And I'm very excited about, I mean, I made my crappy little demos look gorgeous. I mean, it seems, I even look professional when I when I theme my apps this way. And it's just one call away.
And with respect to to other people who have tried theming things like this, like jQuery Mobile, like they push that theme thing a lot, but it's mostly just colors. With your stuff, it really is like a whole person. It's almost like a personality might be even a better word than a theme.
Yeah, and it's also, and we understand that some people want to have, for example, one theme for the application, but they want settings to be a different theme. So we provide you enough tools that you can do that. If you just use the defaults, you'll get everything styled, but you can certainly have different parts of your application styled differently. One thing that people tend to do is settings use lighter colors while the application is dark, right? So your app is entirely dark, and when you go to settings, it's all very clear, right? So we do provide that. So we're very, very happy with this. It looks very professional.
Very cool.
Even my software looks good.
People can check this out at Xamarin.com, and I would really encourage people, this is just me talking, to click on Tour and then How It Works. I think that of all the pages on your site, that is the best one. It's a great page. Like, I would put that up front and center. It shows before and after. It shows Objective-C versus C#. I mean, it makes the argument basically that C# is just better than Objective-C for being expressive. Maybe it's just the examples that you picked, but man, it sure is attractive, to see it side by side like that.
Yeah, actually, that is one of my babies. I really enjoy what you can do with C#. In this particular page that you're talking about, we turn some fairly nasty APIs into very simple uses using default parameters, name parameters, C# constructors. We turned a fairly ugly low-level C property fetching into clean C# properties. So that's one of the things that we're very proud of. We turned this low-level API into a clean, nice C# API. And you know, as much as I love C#, you know, the F# guys are really they're kind of on a warpath to show that even if we can make the code smaller with C# than the original Objective-C, they can kill another 50% of your app. So they can make it 50% smaller. Mm-hmm. So I'm really enjoying to see what the F# guys are doing here. with mobile apps. They're very motivated, and they're really big into showing that a fraction of the code in F-sharp actually looks nicer. So we're actually working with them to make sure that that F-sharp makes it into all of these products.
Very cool. Well, I am actually in the process of using the Xamarin Universal Installer right now, and it is installing Android at this moment. So thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Oh, thank you, Scott. It was a pleasure.
All right. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.